Humphrey, and I am with Thales College. I'm the director of admissions there and on faculty, and I am delighted to be a part of this panel as we contemplate revolutions and renewal in higher education. Surely an exciting topic and one that is timely. I won't say a lot about Thales College, but it's a new venture that's being launched in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is our soft launch this year, and we have a hard launch next year. Our concept is trying to bring affordability, liberal arts, and professional career development together in a thoughtful way. I do have some brochures, so if anyone is interested or has students, come talk to me afterward. I'd love to tell you more about it. Why now? Why found new institutions now? To me, it must be that we've given up in a large part on the attempt to reform old institutions. There are some that are doing noble work, and there's possibility of really good reform, but I think that the existence of this panel shows that there's a lot of people who are more and more convinced that we need to be founders and founding new institutions. My own belief is that the United States, as we see it today, is being torn asunder into two different peoples. Why do I think this? We know from St. Augustine and Cicero and others that what constitutes a people is common agreement on and common affection for some form of justice that affects the common understanding and of law and how it's interpreted, but most especially how the young are educated. We know from Aristotle that a regime cannot help but insist that the education of the young be brought into strict conformity with the particular view of justice of the regime. And thus, the battle for education is always, in part, a political battle. Now, on one hand, this threatens to subvert the noble end of education that seeks truth, no matter the form of the regime. And this threat must be taken seriously. In fact, if this end is lost, all is lost. On the other hand, though, one must keep a watchful eye on the political battle over what conception of justice will predominate in the regime. As James Madison wrote once to a friend, "What spectacle can be more edifying and more seasonable than that of liberty and learning, each leaning on the other for a mutual and sure support?" Liberal learning then depends largely on having the political liberty to pursue it. Now, some people will point to the 1860s and other people to the 1960s as times when such battles were fought decisively. But make no mistake, this battle is perpetual. There is no neutral time, no era of good feelings, when institutions of higher learning can safely close their eyes to this public concern. And again, I take it as evidence of this panel that institutions that are here represented have come to be persuaded that this is a time for refounding. So we find ourselves less as conservatives of old institutions and more as an insurgency with an aim to create critical space where we can found new institutions. And I propose two strategies as we go forward. One is, in the face of expected increasing opposition, we must rededicate ourselves and our curricula to the study and contemplation of what Thomas Jefferson described as the elemental books of public right, Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, and Sidney, or what he names, as well as others. And we must instill in students a reverence, neither dogmatic worship nor historicist indifference, for the classical authors, and especially those of our own tradition, who were shaped by them, in order to keep alive that flame of the vigilant and manly spirit that Madison claimed actuates the people of America, and important for purposes of higher education, nourishes freedom, and in turn is nourished by it. Indeed, Jefferson credited the influence of reverence for these authors with making the logic of the Declaration of Independence common sense or self-evident among the American colonists. But, and with all due respect to Alan Bloom and Mortimer Adler, the great books alone will not save us. Great books may arm us with excellent arguments against those who would seek to cancel us, but those weapons are powerless in the face of hostile interlocutors. As Polemarchus proclaims, when he and his friends accost Socrates and Glaucon as they were attempting to return to Athens in the opening scene of Plato's Republic, quoting Bloom's translation here nonetheless, "Could you really persuade us if we don't listen? And further, do you see how many of us there are?" Remember, King George III refused even to read the Continental Congress's 1775 Olive Branch petition, the final effort to avoid war. Indeed, sometimes persuasion must give way to force. And so my second suggested strategy is just this. We need allies. If we are to hold on to our independence, we need allies. We must not only found new and good institutions, we must likewise found new associations of institutions. This for many practical purposes, but most importantly, in order to confer legitimacy on one another. Because the key strategy that the opposition will use against us is to delegitimize us in the eyes of would-be students and the society at large. Colleges and universities traffic in prestige above all else. Hence, Harvard and Yale wield immense power because people think they are worthy of it. Theoretically, this prestige is also bolstered by the stamp of approval from things like accreditation boards. We at Thales College are convinced that this system has outlived its usefulness. It is, though, a prudential matter, perhaps, about which friends can disagree. As we consider creating a parallel universe of higher education, one that generates prestige based on merit and accomplishment, let us be friends. I take the recommendation for a plumber from a friend any day over what Google tells me. Likewise, let us consider an economy based on friendship. I recognize your legitimacy because you are my friend and I know your worth. And when you do the same for me, we create our own legitimizing source of prestige in the minds of potential students. This exact thing is already happening in the growing and hugely successful classical movement among the K-12 schools. They have associations that are robust networks of help, mutual help, and fellowship. In fact, if you want to take a look, one's meeting just three blocks from here this very weekend, called the Society for Classical Learning. I therefore urge conversation on the question, how do we create not only new institutions, but whole parallel system of higher education based on some form of unity? Here we tread on dangerous ground, for we're likely to disagree if we insist on too narrow a basis. And yet we risk being picked off one by one, or hanged separately if we do not hang together, as Benjamin Franklin quipped about the colonies. All friendship, Aristotle teaches us, is based on some commonly loved thing. What shall be the basis of our friendship? We here at the Philadelphia Society can be friends because we all love liberty, and we love arguing about the nature of this thing we both love, even though our knowledge of this thing is imperfect and is only barely able to rise above the level of opinion in most cases. So as we contemplate revolution and renewal in higher education, I propose as the basis for our friendship a common affection rising to the level of steadfast reverence for the Western tradition and unflinching defense of the American regime, as articulated by our founders, who likewise revered that tradition, even in the face of expected epithets of racism, as we stand athwart the gusts of the gathering storm. But further, let us commit to steadfast loyalty and devotion to each other in this great cause, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. Let us mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Such friendship will surely win us more friends and even more enemies, but it will raise us up in the eyes of potential students, of each other, and of ourselves. And that kind of friendship is something indeed beautiful. We have three panels. Oh, I forgot my bio. Here we go. We have a great speaker and respondents with us today. The first is Pano Canellos. Let me tell you a little bit about him, and then I will tell you a little about the responders, and then I'll let them go. Pano Canellos was the president of St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland from 2013 to 2017. And prior to that appointment, he served as the professor of literature and drama at Stanford, the University of San Diego, and Loyola University, and as dean of the Honors College at Valparaiso University. Canellas has written and spoken widely on the freedoms that are essential to liberal education. And while at St. John's, he was named one of the most innovative and entrepreneurial college presidents in America by Forbes for his work reducing tuition costs at the college while creating a new financial model for institutions of higher education. As of July 2021, Canellas has been serving as the CEO and the president of UATX, but I'll let him tell you more about that. Following Canellas, we have Gabriel Calzada, who is the president of the Universidad Francisco Marroquín, the pioneering free market university in Guatemala. He is vice president of the Montpellier Society and a board member of the Rising Tide Foundation. In his native Spain, he was the founding president of Juan de Mariana Institute, a think tank known for the impact of its innovative research. Gabriel's 2009 study on the negative impact of the Spanish government's promotion of green jobs, along with his testimony before the U.S. Congress, helped to bury that initiative. He holds a PhD in economics from the Universidad Rey Juan Carlos in Spain. He served as a professor of economics at the IE University and the Universidad Rey Juan Carlos. He spends his weekends adventuring along the back roads of Guatemala with his wife Karen, three daughters, and two border collies. And finally, Glenn Arbery, born in South Carolina and like myself, reared in Georgia, grew up as a Southerner and a Protestant, but his reading of Flannery O'Connor as a freshman at the University of Georgia began his journey toward the Roman Catholic Church. A convert at 25, he entered the church at the University of Dallas, where he met his wife-to-be, Virginia, and later took his PhD in literature and politics with a dissertation on Shakespeare's comedies. He has taught literature at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Thomas More College of Liberal Arts, University of Dallas, and Assumption College, where he held the Dalzon Chair of Liberal Education. In 2013, he and his wife, Virginia, also a PhD from the University of Dallas, went to Wyoming Catholic College to teach humanities, trivium, and philosophy, and Dr. Arbery became president of Wyoming Catholic in 2016. He has written a number of books, including two novels, and edited several more. He and his wife, Virginia, have eight children, 24 grandchildren, and an unknown number of border collies. With that, I give you Pano Canellas.